Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cup podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris Effects. I'm Steve Hulfish, ACE. I'm a working film, TV, and documentary editor. Over the last 10 years, I've done more than 400 interviews with the world's best editors. Welcome to episode 20 of season 10. I've been using Boris Effects products for 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today on Art of the Cut, we speak with the editors of the Apple TV Plus series Foundation, based on Isaac Asimov's sci-fi trilogy. On the call today are Paul Trejo, ACE, Miklos Wright, ACE, Emily Green, ACE, Sydney Walensky, ACE, and Olivia Wyrick. Paul Trejo has cut TV series including Black Sails, Carnival Row, Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan, and Lock and Key. He was also the sound editor on Scarface and The Cotton Club. Miklos Wright edited Open Range, Mr. Brooks, Luke Cage, and 3,000 Miles to Graceland. He's currently cutting Kevin Costner's Western series, Horizon. Emily Green edited TV series including Mrs. America, Carnival Row, American Crime Story, and the pilot of The Rookie. Sydney Walensky has been on Art of the Cut previously for his work on Greyhound, Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water, and The Sopranos. His other work includes Boardwalk Empire, House of Cards, and The Walking Dead. Olivia Wyrick, as you will hear, recently moved into the editing chair for Foundation after working as an assistant on the show and as an assistant or online editor for shows like The Walking Dead, Fear the Walking Dead, The Mentalist, and Spider-Man Apprentice. Before I hop into our discussion with Paul, Miklos, Emily, Olivia, and Sydney, a brief thank you to our partner, Boris Effects. I've been using Boris Effects and Sapphire for 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me to deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris Effects is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris Effects suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optics, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmarked. And now, Paul Trejo, ACE, Miklos Wright, ACE, Emily Green, ACE, Sydney Walensky, ACE, and Olivia Wyrick. I am going to start with the ladies to get a sense of who everybody's voice is. Emily, could you introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Emily Green, and I was the editor on episode 3, King and Commoner, episode 7, Unnecessary Death, and episode 10, the finale, Creation Myths.
Olivia?
Hi, I'm Olivia Wyrick, and I just edited one episode, was 204, Where the Stars Are Scattered Thinly.
Sydney?
Sydney Walensky, I edited with Miklos. I guess Miklos had another commitment, so I took over episode 9 of season 2.
Hi, everyone. This is Miklos Wright, and I edited episodes 2, 6, and 9 of season 2, and shared a screen with Sydney Walensky for episode 9, who did a tremendous job of delivering a very difficult episode.
Paul?
Hi, everyone. My name is Paul Trejo. I edited the finale, season 2. I did 201. In the trenches now with Olivia on the third season.
When we're dealing with material that has come from previous IP, is did any of you read the book?
I did not read the book, and I recall going into my interview with David Goyer. And I'm such a terrible liar that I went in and I was like, I haven't read the book. I'm not even a science fiction fan. I feel like I just blurted it out. And I was like, there went the interview. But it turned out as our conversation went on that perhaps I was the perfect viewer in the sense that I said, I'm not super well read on science fiction, but I read the script for 101. I also was on season 1 and I loved it. So the script tells a story. I'm excited. I'm intrigued. I want to know more. I want to see it. And I think that, yeah, that definitely galvanized him and was like, all right, okay, this could be, even for the non-science fiction lovers, could be something that brings everyone in.
Anybody thoughts on the advantages or disadvantages of reading the source material on anything you've ever cut?
The version that we show is so dramatically adapted from the original source material. Really, one of the great joys of reading this original IP was you could get to see the fantastic mind of David Goyer translate that from the page to the stage to the screen and really do some tremendous things. A fantastic thing to check out.
I have to echo that because David told me that he had a lot of people like Jim Cameron and say, you got a lot of brass going after this one because this one is really difficult to adapt. With his genius, he made it his own. He really created new characters that weren't always in the trilogy.
One of the downsides of reading the source material is then you start second-guessing all the choices the writers made. You kind of think, gee, there was that really interesting thing, and they didn't use that at all, or something like that. So there is sort of a downside, although often I try to read, if it is based on a book, I try to read the book.
Yeah, there's about a 50-50 split of editors who feel like they're better off not reading it so that they don't have preconceived notions. They're not putting story ideas that they know in their head and assuming that they're in the story than when they're not. So, and then others who feel like it's very important. What about collaboration between the editors? Were you ever in the same place at the same time for this editing, or were you able to collaborate in any way or speak into each other's episodes?
I think that's germane to first season because pre-COVID, there was another editor, Skip McDonald, who was involved. And we would just have ad hoc conversations in the hallway and stuff. But once March of 2020, we all working from home.
Did you find that you needed to watch each other's episodes, or the people that cut just at season two needed to go back and watch season one?
Had to watch the episodes. There's too much going on. I got jumped in a little bit because I came in a little bit towards the end of season one, or I came in after the first break of COVID. Maybe I had an advantage. So there was cuts to look at and I watched a bunch. But, you know, it's a show. We're all desperately trying to stay ahead of the dailies and make our deliveries. It's a lot of head down for myself anyway, and just trying to get this ambitious material wrangled. These guys are terrific. We were expected to cut our own previouslys on. And so, you know, you at least had to watch the episode before yours.
Those previously ons, a lot of times they're handed off to an assistant. Did any of you feel like you could do that with your assistant, or do you like doing those previously on edits? Emily?
All of the previously ons were definitely delegated to the assistant. I find those so tricky because, you know, you've got a very compact amount of time to just really dynamically tell it all. But, you know, and as the episodes go on, there's more to tell. And I, even watching the season two previously on, I mean, that is a heavy lift on the whole season one, reminding you of everything that happened, especially in this kind of show where there are so many worlds, so many crossovers, so many characters. My assistant editor, Phil Hamilton, actually is now cutting on season three. He really proved himself, not only in the previously ons, but did a couple of sizzle reels and really just did a beautiful job in season one and season two. And so he's now cutting on season three. So it's a great opportunity for assistant editors, you know, to really shine, I think, in the previously ons and other opportunities, especially thinking about like sound work on this show. It's epic. It's a lot of work. And I think definitely an all hands on deck feeling.
Paul, I was struck by the complexity of the story. How do you juggle the need to understand the story, this complex story, and the need for the audience to feel something? There's so much exposition that has to be done. How do you balance that?
My North Star has always been emotion and cutting for what you're feeling in your gut. It is a matrix in a sense of juggling the story, multiple stories. I think it could be said that season one was probably not quite as complex as two, and then season three is even more so. It's really a tricky thing to kind of mentally focus on all the cross storylines going on and yet still developing the character. I mean, Dave, for example, is played by Lee Pace, is just a wealth of talent. You can't lose with him, because he gives you so much. It's sad sometimes to have to leave certain performances and certain character things kind of on the ways, you know, the outtakes?
I would say, although, you know, I haven't been that involved in this series, that generally as an editor, you're working at a kind of a very granular level. I mean, you're working scene by scene, trying to make the scenes work, getting everything you can out of the material you have. A lot of the complexity of keeping the story going is stuff that's should have been dealt with at the script level. It should work. Often it doesn't. And at that point, you, as an editor, you until you're really collaborating with the writer, the producer, whoever it is, the showrunner, you can't really deal with that. At that point, it's very exciting to be moving things around and deleting things and repurposing stuff to achieve a goal. Initially, although scene by scene, you're thinking of who said what previously and where it's going, you're working sort of granularly.
Emily?
I agree with what both Sydney and Paul were saying. I think that the scope and the grandeur of this show from season one, the writing was just perfectly executed in a way that by the time it got to us, obviously with something that kind of budget, because it is so complex and there are so many worlds and being told. I've worked on shows where there's a lot of shuffling and a lot of reworking and a lot of inventing scenes. But in my experience on this, everything felt like it was pretty buttoned down in terms of the storytelling so that, yeah, by the time it got to us, we could really hone in on the granular editing and on each scene. Of course, referring to our previous episodes and conferring with the other editors. And thankfully, the actors were incredible and we were able to really focus in on performances and emotion and the action, because there's plenty of all of that.
Oftentimes people mention the word style and they get kind of confused about like, well, what's the style of the editing and how do you keep it in a similar way, particularly when you have multiple editors on the show, four editors? I mean, we're all very experienced. It all just sort of unfolds. It looks as though it's all one mind, one personality, one sensibility that's cutting it. It's not to say that Miklos has one way of doing overlaps or Sydney has another way of doing establishing a scene. You know, I'm particularly impressed with the uniformity of the style.
Emily, talk to me a little bit about the beginning of the finale episode. It was editing between two characters back and forth. How closely did those intercutting edits happen compared to the script? Or did you find that throughout the process you needed to change when you chose to cut between one character and the other?
There was definitely an idea and an intention, but that's also not to say that there... I will also say that there were a lot of variations in that opening. We did one version which was super tight, super like just, it was almost felt like jump cutting. And to give the idea of the choking, the suffocating, the grasping for breath and for life. But I think when we reviewed it, it was like, whoa, I can't quite follow everything that's happening. Let's give it a little bit more breath, for lack of a better word. We played around more than anything else with the pacing, but the whole intention was always to make it as seamless as possible between Gail and Harry, as though they were one person. So as the hand is climbing up on the cliff, I would try to match it frame for frame exactly in mid movement from his hand to her hand. So it felt like it was just the same hand, maybe from left to right. And then just quiet dissolves in between when Harry looks into the water and the reflection. And for a second, you think you see Harry, but it's actually Gail. So yeah, there were all a lot of little playing around with little nuanced moments, but in terms of what it was and where it went, the material was more or less always how I laid it out, but it was just the pacing that was mainly sort of played around with.
Have any of the rest of you ever tried that kind of slash and burn technique of you overly tighten something to see how much you can cut out, to see what needs to be opened up?
I mean, one of the conditions that we are facing in the show is that we have a time constraint we have to deal with. We've got a wonderful script, but, you know, you run into what I did on episode 9 before I handed off to Sydney. I was running north of 70 minutes on something that needs to be 50 minutes. And now you're looking at making some pretty dramatic changes and some pretty dramatic shifts in how the story is going to work. That was really a powerful thing to watch that final version from my perspective, having really struggled. It began at 86 minutes. So I felt like I'd done a huge job of reducing it to 72 minutes without dropping a scene. I went looking for 6 frames here and 8 frames there and And I mean, that's how you really have to do it in a streaming or a broadcast show. There's something really amazing, though. I have to compliment Sydney as powerfully here, because the kind of amazing thing that I saw happen, being in the trenches with it and then being able to step away and then come back and see it, was really a powerful conversation about the value of setup versus payoff in terms of like how much do you have to cue the audience up for an idea before you bring them to it so that it has a weight and has a meaning. And it's really quite a riddle for shows such as these, where, you know, have these directors are going out and shooting these mini features, and then we have to turn around and go back, you know, an answer to our producing team that's trying to make a streaming show that they ultimately want to put on television syndication someday. We can't deliver a 70-minute episode. We can't even deliver a 65-minute episode. You know, you really have to get it down close to these targets. And that's a super duper challenge. I'm really inspired, Sydney, by what the work you did on our episode 9. I couldn't see a way out of that forest. When I got there, when it was done, I finally started noticing things that had been dropped, things that had been moved away and gone. And I was watching the episode with my wife, and I noticed that she didn't miss anything. And everything was landing terrifically. It's really, Sydney, I got to tell you, man, I've had to rethink how much I value setup and the role that it plays. It's incredibly important. I don't know about the rest of you, but it was one of the first things I learned that you know, editing is all about setup and payoff. Set it up, pay it off, time it out, you know, intercut the setups, you know, deliver the payoff. In that show, there are huge scenes that hit the floor in 9. Big, big sequences with exposition, you know, raw backstory for characters. Kudos to you, sir. It really, really was streamlined effectively. You know, I watched it and only kind of was doing the math later on. And I got to just tell you, like, when it got to the end and General Yost is having his conversation with this man on the surface, you know, and their relationship was at stake and they're having a big goodbye. And, you know, this is a big spoiler for anybody listening to this, but there's a fatality about to happen. And they refer to this book that they've read. They make these references to things that we had big scenes to set up and to make sure that that emotion would land for the audience. It was so much better without it. I was amazed. It was incredible. And so I've been applying more of that mindset to more of my work about how, you know, when you're looking for that tightening, that's the balancing act. Like, just how much setup do you really need before, in the moment, the exposition is delivering it? That's a really, you know, got to do a lot of wiggling in there. But that's a good place to look for when you're trying to tighten something up.
I will go right over to Sydney then. Tell us a little bit about what you found that, you know, obviously you've got to get rid of stuff. How do you make those decisions?
I want to thank Miklos. I guess I never really think in terms of setup and payoff. You know, when it's too long, you look, first of all, in any kind of action stuff, what can you get rid of and still tell the story? I mean, how much can you jump somebody when they're walking down the stairs or whatever, or moving from one place to another? That's one thing. And then in dialogue scenes, you look for repetition, because writers always tend to kind of repeat the same thing over and over again, and then they go to the next thing and repeat it. And you just find out which chunks you can drop and have the dialogue be feel continuous and natural and not lose any meaning. So those are sort of the two major things. I can't remember what exactly we dropped. There was a lot of intercutting between fighting and stuff, and I think I tried to push that together, but luckily, unlike Miklos, I didn't have to make the fight work. I just could find the little chunks that we didn't need. It's sort of a paring down process. Little by little, you're getting close to that 60-minute mark, and you think, okay, let's take another look. There's got to be something we can get rid of. Really, a lot of these dialogue scenes, and I found this, and I'm sure you all have in other shows as well, it's like there's just so many ideas that are repeated, and the audience knows all this stuff. They figure it out really fast. They don't have to be, you know, hammered away with the same idea. So
true.
I think in this particular episode, you know, there are big long scenes between Harry Seldon and the Lee Pace character. They go on and on and on and repeat the same stuff, and you can just go from thought to thought to thought without the reinforcement. And then occasionally, like at the end, I felt it needed more intercutting to really jack up the emotions.
Sydney Wilinski, editorial assassin.
Absolutely.
It's an interesting idea that you did the cutting down and didn't do the assembling, because it almost makes it less painful, maybe, or opens your mind up to the possibilities where if you built it, you know why you built something. So why would you deconstruct it if you built it?
There's no question about that. And that's why, you know, when the producer comes in and they say, well, what about this and what about that? Oh, yeah, that's right. We don't need that. Or the director really wanted that in, so I couldn't get it out. But you can't really say that all the time. So the person who comes in and takes a fresh look is in a much better position. And as an editor, you have to try to force yourself to have that vision, even though you're not the first person.
Olivia, can you tell me a little bit about your episode and maybe some of the things that you discovered after you built the thing up about what had to happen to get it, maybe not to a specific time, but to get it to feel the right length?
Yeah, my episode, it was an interesting one for me because it was actually my very first editing episode ever. I started as an assistant, thank you, on season one, and worked, you know, very closely with David Goyer and Skip, as Paul mentioned, on the first episode. And became very familiar with the show, and they asked me back as an editor on season two, which was great. So it was my very first, episode ever. So that certainly was a challenge in and of itself, coming into such a huge and epic show, as Emily said, as a first-time editor. There were a lot of challenges, and we also had that episode was a new director as well. So managing a new director and a new editor on that team had its own set of challenges, and it was hard at first because I had to kind of cut the way I wanted to and the way the director wanted to, but then also had to realize that at the end of the day it's gonna go back to the producers and it's gonna be, you know, David Goyer, the showrunner, it's gonna be his vision at the end of the day. So we definitely went through a lot of changes in that aspect, and I think like the editor's cut to the final version was very different. We went in and we cut a lot, as everybody was saying, a lot of dialogue. 204 was a very like dialogue driven episode. It was more character driven. There weren't any huge epic fight scenes and battles as later in the show, later in the season. So it was much more character driven, which was nice in a way, but also tricky because you have to figure out what to cut because it is mostly dialogue. And then you don't want to cut something that is then going to be important later in the season. And as we were kind of talking about in the beginning of the conversation, you know, watching each other's episodes, if you don't know that something is important later on and then you cut it, it can create confusion. So it's just, you know, you kind of need to have that overall, you know, vision of it, but still concentrate on your own scene. So it was definitely tricky. But I think overall we ended up getting there and it turned into a strong episode. And it was a good one to kind of develop some of these characters that we hadn't seen in season one and give them a little more depth, which I think was nice to the overall season two.
Emily and Paul, would you care to speak into how Olivia was promoted to this position? Was it an attitude that you saw, a willingness to collaborate? Why one assistant is promoted to an editing position instead of another?
Olivia was and continues to be an incredible asset since the pilot. The pilot, as is the case in most shows, was an absolute bear. The pilot episode of season one of Foundation, you can imagine all the foundation that's being laid in. Olivia, you were assisting Skip, and I don't remember how everything all went. If at one point it went longer than had anticipated, there was a shift of editors and you were there the entire time and you essentially became the point person and you were also helping out with visual effects. And I think you really proved yourself to everyone, including especially David Goyer. And I think he saw how much you knew where all the bodies were buried. Just that you were skilled and multi-skilled, and I think he saw the potential and also the, you know, you were really giving it your all and your dedication. And David is wonderful in so many ways, and one of those ways is that he really recognizes and promotes within, and I think that was an opportunity for him to be like, okay, you've definitely proved yourself.
As editors, we go through a lot of assistants. I would have to say that most you're not quite sure of, but when it comes to Olivia, I knew immediately that she had it. She had rhythm, she had collaboration, she had energy, great with music, great with visual effects, because I think she was an online editor on some big show. As far as I could tell, it's just the ultimate team player. If you have a question about something, she's like on it right away, you know, with an answer. Oh yeah, it was because of this, and you can find it here, and just a joy to work with on this team.
That's so sweet. I love it. And now another assistant has been promoted. Olivia, what do you think it was about Phil? Could you tell that he might be the next one in line?
Yes, actually, because on season two, he was Emily's assistant. And like she mentioned, he cut a couple of teasers. And I think he cut the blooper reel that we all watched. And they were all phenomenal. It was so good. And similarly, you know, I guess with me, David recognized that he is a team player, always was there. He would pick up the slack of cutting things that maybe the editors don't want to cut because they don't have time, or, you know, and not to say that he had time, because assistants are almost as busy, if not busier, than the editors sometimes with dailies and sound and exports and turnovers. So to find the time to do additional work to prove how good he was, I think, like we all said, David recognizes that. So we're all very excited to have him for season three.
What was happening with production and kind of some of the complexities of dealing with such a large show?
We shoot everything at the same, all episodes kind of at once, which is very unique. Most shows will shoot per episode, 8 to 10 days of one episode each. But for season two, and I think season one, maybe two, because we shoot by location. So we have to get all the scenes done from that location. So you can get dailies for your episode one, and you can get dailies for your episode nine at the same time. So it's hard to balance.
Season one, they were in about 5 or 6 different countries. They were in Malta, Spain, they were in the Canaries. Everything germane to that location across the board, across all 10 episodes, has to be covered, obviously, logistically, while they're in one location. But it's interesting on this show, because some weeks you kind of have catch-up time, you know, you have a rest time, you're not seeing any film. But like just this week alone, I've got 301, 305, and 309 dailies just slamming me. And, you know, hopefully I'm going to get a week where I can catch up and take a breath, you know.
I'm a huge fan of crossboarding. It's exactly what Paul is saying. And what Olivia is saying is, due to the nature of it being shot on location, you're getting chunks from different episodes at the same time. And I find it to be a delight, because yes, you get inundated at times with multiple episodes and you're juggling your heads trying to figure out. But at the same time, you also get to play catch up usually, because then they're shooting episode 204 and 8. And in the meantime, you have time to really kind of wrap your head around things. And I don't know how you all feel about it, but I like the crossboarding, because it feels like there's a seemingly endless period of dailies, which is a delight. You really get time to hone things.
Does it make it difficult to assemble your story? When do you take a scene and attach it to another scene? And do you have to, obviously, with this kind of crossboarding, and could be months before you're putting that, you know, scene 12 with scene 13?
Cards, lots of cards.
Lots of cards.
Totally. Plug it.
Just that's how I keep my brain straight. I just had to I would have my assistant just card the entire show, and I just kind of fill it in as I go. I was doing 3 episodes, you know, and you're trying to, like guys say, wrap your head around it. That was my crutch.
Me too. Yeah, because you could literally be jumping between 3 different episodes in one day of cutting, depending on if the scenes that are coming in. And so, yeah, it's agreed. The slugs were the key to everything.
What about things like sound? Were you trying to like build out a world? I know with a lot of things, literally you're dealing with other worlds. Does one world sound different to another? And are you trying to do that while you're cutting dailies, or do you wait until much later?
Usually for sound, that's the assistant's job, is to take a scene that the editor cuts and basically do all the sound. And luckily for season two, we had done season one already, so, and it was finished at the time, so you could pull from, we went back to Terminus, you can kind of go back to a scene since season one and see how we mastered the sound and kind of imitate that for season two. So the longer you have a show going on, I wouldn't say the easier it is, but you can pull from previous seasons to kind of build the world. But it was, in terms of the final sound, in season one, I was in the room for a lot of conversations with Sound Dogs, who was our final sound mixing company. And there were a ton of conversations with David and the guys at Sound Dogs about, for example, how the vault was going to sound, you know, when it's emitting its the null field, and how certain creatures were going to sound. So in season two, we had Becky. I'm blanking on the what kind of animal she is.
Dragon.
She's some kind of creature.
Was that beast?
Tiger dragon.
There was a lot of conversation about how her roar was going to sound. Oh, Bishop's Claw.
Bishop's Claw.
Well nice. Done. Good memory.
So that is kind of more in the final stages of sound. But then as an assistant editor, it's your job to kind of put that in before the final sound gets there, because it's very hard to watch something with no backgrounds, no Foley, no sound effects. So that's a very big part of being an assistant editor.
How do you prep your assistants to do that work for you? Do you give them free rein, or do you give them a few notes on what your thoughts are? And then what do you do when you hear what they've cut for you?
I'd like to give my assistant free rein, unless there's something very specific. And then you look at the scene with the assistant and you kind of give them notes. If you tell them what you exactly want, they'll try to do exactly what you want, and you kind of shut down the possibility of unexpected things that they come up with. So I like to hear what somebody comes up with and then say, that's great, and that's great, and what about this? Could we do this slightly differently? And that's sort of my approach.
I've been working with Phil Hamilton for about 5 years now. And so we've definitely gotten to a rhythm of knowing, you know, I pass off the scene. But ever since the beginning, it's always been free reign. And I'm always delighted and surprised by what comes back to me, because there's so much creativity and so much potential in sound work. And it is a moment for an assistant editor to shine, because I do think half the scene is the sound. I'm a huge proponent of what a difference it can make. Phil would fill the timeline of beds and sound effects and unexpected Foley. Like, I don't know if there's a scene and then in the background you would hear, like, you know, from the little things like a refrigerator humming or something, like someone coughing in the background that you wouldn't even think, but he's thinking 360 degrees. And I think that really it always elevates the scene, but it definitely elevates the potential for the sounds. And then it's a guide for later on. And then Sound Dogs took it and they did incredible work. I think it was all the episodes were already in great shape with the temp sound, but they really elevated as well. So
does it change the pacing when you get really good sound work in, that it either allows you to tighten or allows you or makes you want to open it up so that the sound design has a chance to breathe? Or
coming from a film background, my starting point is always just dialogue and picture. If it works that way, then I know that I'm off to the races. And I can anticipate the pauses and where an off-screen sound is going to occur or something like that. So I know it's only going to get better. I agree with Sydney. I really look forward to hearing what my assistant can bring to the scene, you know, to take it up 10 notches, you know. And then, of course, with music, that's a whole nother. It's a time-consuming process, but ultimately very rewarding.
The assistant gets my first cut on a scene and works on that. And the sound may be great, but when I take and look at it, I'll suddenly see, oh, darn, I got to do a whole bunch of stuff on the scene. And I'll often feel quite guilty because I got to cut into all their effects. But it's not really the sound that's governing that. If there were no sound there, I'd still look at the scene again and say, oh, I got to tighten up all this dialogue, or this action could go a lot faster. That's just sort of the nature of a cut evolving before you feel comfortable to show it to a director.
I was just listening to an interview I did with someone where they were talking about muting all that sound work because it can affect you. For example, if there's a ring out on a gunshot, you wouldn't want to cut out in the middle of the ring out. But if you don't hear the ring out, then you can cut out where it's visually correct. The sound can actually be preventing you from making the right visual edit.
Especially with temp score.
Yeah, it can be distracting if there's something that it's wrong, like a hard cut or it's supposed to be a ring out or the backgrounds don't match. I find that can take away from the visual aspect of it because there's something wrong. You notice something's wrong and sometimes it's hard to pinpoint what that is. So sometimes it is easier to mute all of the temp sound so that you just have the dialogue track and then you know if something feels weird, it's definitely a visual thing.
Miklos, you mentioned temp score. What did you temp with? Were you temping because you knew the composer you were going to be dealing with, or did you just temp with anything that you wanted to temp with?
There's that riddle of what's the music going to be in season one versus season two when you've got it realized. And season one, it was all over the place. Really trying to discover the sound. We knew it needed to be classic, but it needs to have a science fiction feel. So I remember getting good traction with anything that had significant percussion, give it a drive and hit things, you know, in a big way. I remember when I came on, I was doing my first episode and I was checking out a lot of the work and I thought, geez, you know, it's getting really dark. And it's just really, really dark. And I, you know, and so go hunting for some kind of music that maybe allows the audience a little bit of a respite from the heaviness. You know, that's a really big job we have, is trying to figure out the tone of what the music's going to be. You go looking for everything. I got a lot of traction out of Fury Road, which was just this bombastic craziness. You know, when someone starts a foot chase, you know, and I could always lean into that, no problem. I mean, we all kind of have our favorite scores we probably work with over the years. We know we can rely on a certain kind of emotion coming from it. I mean, I've been in watching a show, watching a feature, and I'm hearing an original composer, and I'm like, you've been influenced by, the end of Inception. You know, you've got that famous Hans Zimmer cue. It's blowing your mind, and now you've got a ripoff of it. The temp score, it's really dangerous because you can convince yourself a scene is working because you've got this genius cue that someone wrote forever ago. That's the first thing I mute. Just when I'm checking my work, I'm like, well, what's it like if I take this crutch away? Can I, does it still stand up? You know, how's it go? How's it work?
When do you put in temp? Do you feel like you need to do it when you're in the dailies thing, or are you waiting till you have a couple of scenes together?
It's kind of a scene by scene basis. If I've got a scene and I want to take it to another level emotionally so I can gauge the effectiveness of the decisions, I'll start laying some score in right away, especially if I think of something's good, you know, it's like in the back of my mind.
If I can, I wait until I have all the scenes assembled. I like to cut dry, although you've heard my love for sound, but I like to cut everything dry. And then when I start wrapping my head around the arc of the episode, I go through and I track it and I add little locators more or less right around here. I want to start feeling this. And I add a little, you know, locator and the feeling that I want to get from that scene. And I go through it and then I go through it again and I try and pull because I sometimes you, it's easy to overscore again, using music as a crutch. And so I go back and so do I really need it there? Now, this was a different situation because of the crossboarding and because sometimes we wouldn't get the scenes until weeks, months later, when I had a few scenes or a chunk of scenes together, that's when I'd start laying down ideas.
Was there a scene that either you're particularly proud of or that was a challenge?
Episode 7 of season 1, David came to me and he wanted to mix it up at the end of 7. He wanted me to take the cards and shuffle the deck. He just wanted it to come at us. It's a scenario where one character is remembering a lot of things. And so there's already in the script, there was a built-in of flashbacks. It wasn't necessarily the old do a flashback when you don't know what else to do kind of scenario. That was already part of the whole process. It was really a great collaboration with David because it was a great example of how he's willing to let go of the material and reach for something more. That's when, if you go back and you take a look at it, you'll start to see kind of the way we were able to take the dialogue that's running in the scene and then make it connect with dialogue from past episodes and then with imagery, kind of bring it all together. It seemed impossible when we started. I love it. I whenever I see it, I think, God, that was so satisfying to have that really come together and then also do what David needed it to do on a story level. You know, he really needed the Gale character, you know, for you to understand their process. They're making some difficult decisions, very difficult at the end of episode 7. And we wanted to make sure the audience was on board and we wanted to do it in a stylish way. And that always sticks out for me as a particular unscripted task that was very satisfying as an editor to take on.
The beginning of 9 was sort of the completion of sort of this ritual that started at the end of 8. And I thought that it needed more material there and that we could just get some more out of 8 and maybe abbreviate it in 8. So I talked to David about it. He liked the idea. And I talked to Paul and he gave me some of that stuff. So we yanked some of that stuff out of there so we could make, because the beginning of the episode, it was too brief to set up what was really going on in that scene. So we got more, we sort of started the scene in the end of 8 and then had more of the scene at the beginning of Nine. I rarely, you know, move stuff from one show to another.
So your job was to cut down Miklos's long episode, and the first thing you suggested was to lengthen it.
Well, it wasn't the first thing, but it wasn't, the lengthening wasn't significant, actually, but it just felt that, like, it needed more meat to the scene at the beginning of an episode so the audience would know what the hell was going on.
Yeah, that's a really little beautiful opening of Nine, the whole Demerzel backstory with her and Lee. It was really special.
Episode 3, King and Commoner, which is actually one that David Goyer directed, and there's this end scene of the Stone Eaters, and they're climbing up a big cliff, and Gail and Salvor have discovered that Harry is actually on the hand of this giant statue, and so they're saving him. But before that, they were underground and they're trying to escape the Stone Eaters. It was just this endless sort of battle, and it was a very tricky scene because it was shot over a period of a few days. So I was getting the material piecemeal. A lot of it was green screen. Some of it was previs, or with these Stone Eaters, it was obviously just a blank screen that would be added later. But some things they did as previs. So it felt like there were just a lot of moving parts for that particular scene. And it felt like, as I was watching all the pieces, I was like, I don't know how this is all gonna come together. But slowly building the pieces, and the days went on, and I just add a chunk and a lot of conferring with the VFX team. And it was a cool collaboration because I think that was an example, and Foundation has many scenes like this where there was a lot of work and collaboration with the VFX team and temping and previses and working on timing. It was a challenge, but I'm really pleased with how it came out.
I had good fortune of editing the episode where Gail comes back to Synax, having been jettisoned from the mothership. It was a very emotional ending because she discovers that her home planet of Synax is completely underwater, probably due to climate change or something. She discovers there's a woman that claims to be her daughter. It was very emotional. It was a scene that we had to let it breathe.
What about you, Olivia, having this be your first episode, sitting in the chair?
Luckily, like I said, it was a lot of dialogue scenes, which were just not as tricky as, say, that giant visual effects scene at the end of 3. But I did have a fight scene in the middle of my episode, and it was kind of I wouldn't say a fun fight. Fun as in, like, it wasn't like a big epic battle like at the end of 209. It was more of the characters, Bell and Glay, come down to this planet. It was kind of a mini excursion for them. They had to get a package and then deliver it back to, you know, and they run into some locals and they get into a little scuffle. And so it was kind of showing off Bell and Glay's fight skills, that they're well-trained and versed in combat against these kind of local characters that were not as good at fighting. But it was tough because shooting by location, they only had that location for a few days. And at the end of it, when they were done shooting the fight, I got an email from David saying that he was worried that they didn't get all the footage. They didn't cover it. So they had me come in and cut the scene pretty quickly because they don't know exactly if they have all the coverage until you get a full scene together. So I had to cut this fight scene in like 2 days, send it back and say, oh yes, we're missing the piece where, you know, this guy gets punched. We don't have a good angle of that. So it was tricky, to say the least, to try to cut this thing very fast. And then I think they did end up having to do some reshoots to get some more coverage of just little sections. But it was definitely a learning curve of my first fight scene and having to do it on short notice.
Congratulations to all of you. What an epic story to be able to tell. I really appreciate all of your time, and good luck on season 3.
Thank you.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, my upcoming book will be in print July 16th, and it's available for pre-order. Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors Volume 2, will provide a topic-driven, curated look at the craft of editing, featuring nearly 300 of the world's best editors. Thanks to Paul Trejo, ACE, Miklos Wright, ACE, Emily Green, ACE, Sydney Wilinski, ACE, and Olivia Wyrick, for
for joining me on Art of the Cut to discuss the editing of Foundation. Thanks also to our partner, BorisFX. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. Thanks for listening. And please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And if you want a good follow on socials, I'm on Twitter and Instagram as @SteveHallfish.